to dimensions unknown, shining a light of truth on the darkest corners of our reality. Welcome to the Curious Realm. Well, hello everybody, and happy Tuesday night. I guess if we're all here listening, we weren't raptured. So, I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing. I guess technically it's a bad thing if we weren't raptured. I wonder if anybody's got an actual population count going, like online somewhere, to see if the weight disbursement changes somewhere. Anyway, just joking, folks. Welcome to the show. Hope everybody's been well. I hope everybody enjoyed the last couple weeks. I know we've had tons of pre-recorded content. I'm starting to swing into my professional season on the road for work, things like that. But in addition, we have been out at tons of conferences, and it has been fantastic to be invited to go out to help cover things, stuff like that. And really be involved in a different way in the different communities that we are involved with. Next week, I am proud to say that we will be having episode 200 of Curious Realm. And we will be premiering our all new animated intro. Thank you so much to our friend Jason McLean, who penned all the amazing artwork that was animated via animated AI systems to help create our intro. It's a fantastic piece. It's going to be great to premiere it. I can't wait for that. We're going to be having Nathaniel Gillis on, talking about necrotech, the idea of technology throughout time being used to possess the soul of people. As well as Dr. John Hall talking about not only targeted individuals, but new protocols within the world of health, and specifically military health protocols that may be able to help families of targeted individuals. So tune in for that next week, folks, for our episode 200 spectacular. That is pre-recorded because I will be on my way to provide AV in Cloudcroft, New Mexico for the International Remote Viewing Association conference. So that's going to be great. We'll, of course, be getting some interviews there. Tonight, we have the pleasure in the second part of being joined by our friend Keith Seeland. We will be talking about the preparedness of humanity for the greater cosmic conversation. Are we ready to talk to ETs as a species? What are things like 3-Eye Atlas mean, all that kind of stuff. We'll be getting into that with Keith Seeland in the second part. In the first part, we are proud to welcome back to the show our friend Susan Walter. She is an angelic artist. She is a frequency mandala artist. When we first met Susan, we were at Stairway to the Stars in Vegas and actively set up right next to your booth for the weekend. So we had plenty of time to hang out and get to know each other. And I was very happy to be able to interview you in a short form there. Mm-hmm. And it was so serendipitous when you reached out to me and were like, hey, you know, I would love to be on the show. And it was like, oh my God, I remember who you are. And just so you folks know, like this is one of the pieces of art. This is the piece of art that I purchased from Susan, which is a beautiful one. It is hearth, a Reiki symbol. And one of the most unique things that I love about your art is the actual incorporation of minerals and crystals. Mm-hmm. This one incorporates quartz dust, amethyst, and dumatierite. So yeah, it's one of those. I am a rocks and minerals fiend. I am, as you know, a binaural beat musician and all about frequency and stuff like that. So to have art like that in my studio, I love, and I get tons of comments on it. And when I tell people, like, oh no, it is impregnated with crystals and crystal material to help enhance the vibration of it, it always starts a conversation. So How did you?
Yeah, I incorporate that dust in almost every piece that I do.
It's absolutely incredible and truly adds a different medium to the medium. You know, so how did you first come to the world of angelic art, frequency art, Susan? And how did you first come to incorporating things like my friends, crystals and minerals into your artwork?
Well, it actually started when I was a kid. I had near-death experiences. I had the first one at the age of 4, and then this another one at the age of 6.
Oh, wow!
Where I, you know, I had to have, you know, some life-saving surgeries because of some medical issues. But and I know I remember with the first one. You know, I grew up in Iowa in very, you know, rural, you know, farming community. And this was in the 1960s. So just aged myself a little bit there. But, yeah, I remember laying on the couch and it was summertime because I know I was wearing a summer dress. And Mom had put a blanket on me and it was so heavy, I couldn't move it. And the doctor actually, you know, came to the house when that used to happen. And I remember them, you know, him taking my temperature and examining me. And then my parents and the doctor went to the next room. And I followed them, but looking down on them. And I wasn't, you know, at that age, I was tiny. And my dad was over 6 foot tall. So me looking down at my dad was, you know, kind of didn't scare me, but it was definitely something I really took notice of. Mm. You know, looking down at my dad was, you know, something different. But yeah, and then and as they're talking, you know, they're deciding if they're going to take me to the local hospital, like 10 minutes away. And the, or to University of Iowa Hospital, which was like an hour away. It was determined because my temperature was reaching 105 that they needed to get me to the hospital as quickly as possible to find out exactly what was going on. But and then while I was in surgery, I and actually even before we even got to the hospital, all of a sudden I'm in this garden. That it glowed is the best way to describe it. And there were these massive trees bigger than anything I'd seen before. And now I would equate them to the size of like the redwoods.
Oh, man.
And underneath one of these trees is three beings that I immediately just recognize as my personal angels. Okay. It's like I remembered them immediately. And because, and especially in the first one, because I was so young, they just occupied my time by asking me if I wanted to see the world through the eyes of the animals. Because I, you know, growing up on the farm, you know, my dad raised hogs, my grandfather and my uncle had cattle. And I was one of those kids, I was notorious. If there was a nest of baby snakes or mice or frogs or whatever, I would just pick them up and gently play with them and then put them back where I found them.
Yeah. Same.
So I was very comfortable with being around animals. So they just occupied my time in the first one. The second one, 2 years later, I'm going back, I'm pretty much back in the exact same garden, in the exact same place. Okay. And the first thing I do is I ask my angels about some things I'm being taught in Sunday school. Because there was things that they just didn't make sense to me. And I don't remember all of the questions that I ask. But I know I did ask how long God's day was. Because me just being a, you know, a little kid.
Sure.
And probably something from my first NDE. It just didn't make sense in my head that God's day was the same as ours.
Mm, yeah.
But, yeah, and then again, I went through, you know, was looking through the eyes of the animals after that. But this time, I went in even to animals I wasn't familiar with.
Oh, interesting.
And ended up eventually swimming in the ocean in a what felt like a very massive body, but moved very slowly. And then all of a sudden, I'm not swimming in water anymore. I'm swimming in space.
Oh, wow.
And from there, I see what I can only describe as, yeah, it's like this really central core of this really intense bright light. And it's almost like that light was breathing, you know, exhales and inhales. And with each exhale, souls were being, the only way I can describe it is being birthed. And like with the inhales, like some of them would go back, but not all of them. And then there'd be another exhale. And then I was shown how when my soul was birthed, that my soul and two others were like pulled aside.
Okay.
And asked to become, to take on a specific role. And I'm still trying to wrap my head around what all that fully entails. And I think, yeah, but, yeah. And then from there, because I did choose to take on this role, the other two did not, and they are to this day some of my personal angels. They are some of my personal guides.
Now,
from there, I went to this place where I went through training with a lot of other what people would generally refer to as ascended masters.
Okay.
So I went through the same training that they did, which was all about sound and frequency and sacred geometry and you know, just energy and light, things like that. And then I was shown from there how the integration into taking on a physical form. And I know this is a long answer.
It's
to
okay. It's
short
okay.
Question. But, yeah, how we, the souls would go be put into different temples in different stages to, you know, to slow our frequency down to be able to take on a physical forms.
Uh-huh.
The very first one was amethyst. I don't remember some of the others in between. And the very last one was garnet before, you know, going on to take on, you know, physical lifetimes.
Okay.
But as I, you know, came back from this experience, this is just a funny little note. My grandmother was sitting at the bedside when I woke up in the hospital. She was reading her favorite magazine, which was National Geographic. And on the front of it was Giza Plateau. And my first question was, and as she realized I'm even awake, is where's the rest of them? Because I just knew there was more on the plateau than what was being shown. But after that experience, you know, I don't remember as much. You know, I was four.
Sure.
If I saw my angels all the time after that one, but I know I did after the experience at six.
Wow.
I just saw my angels all the time and still do.
Now, have they been the same? Because not just at six, but even after that, you've had experiences mm-hmm. with your angels. Have they been the same angels throughout your whole life? Has there been a unified yes. message from your angels throughout your life? Or even a unified theme to message?
Yeah, it's mostly a unified theme and mostly of support. And, you know, because their main reason to be with us is that's who we set down before we take on a physical lifetime to go, okay, I want to learn this. I want to experience this. You know, and so they're the ones keeping us kind of on that path of having those experiences and learning those different lessons.
Interesting, because one of the things that we bring up regularly on the show is the idea of collective consciousness, the idea of we are time does not exist to begin with. Even in physics, it's a made up equation that we have so that things make sense with physics, pretty much. Aside from that, time in and of itself in a universal sense does not exist. So, like, we are basically a conscious vibration, each individually, that are vibrating low enough that we are attracting this physical material that's bound by a quantum field, you know. So, but we've all basically equivocally decided that this is where we're going to be right now, that this is where, for whatever reason, we're here, you know, and it's a fascinating concept to think about.
Yeah, which, you know, the main reason we're here is just to experience.
Yeah.
And it's, and a lot of us, you know, we talk about this being a school and learning lessons. And yes, we are as in human form, but it's all to experience duality, because really on the soul level, we already know it.
Yeah. 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 And it's interesting because without the physicality, we can't experience. You know, we can't understand in that kind of way and gain that kind of literal wisdom. It's like trying to understand how to take apart a car engine without ever being around a car engine. Like, all you have is an owner's manual and maybe a video to watch, you know, like until you get your physical hands on it and get to do that and turn a wrench and mm-hmm. see it and tactily feel it, it's a different realm, and even your brain treats it in a different way.
We were
talking about that before the show, just as somebody who spent time educating children, things like that. Like, we all learn in a different way, and one of those means it's all auditory, visual, but one of them is tactile. And that's mm-hmm. what I am. Like, I can watch things, I can learn, I can listen to things, I can learn, I can write and learn, which is tactile. But boy, howdy, you put that wrench in my hand and you let me do it. Like, it's ingrained. It will never leave me.
Mm-hmm.
And it's fascinating to see that, because even when it comes to manifestation, that's something that I tell people regularly, where they're like, well, I try to manifest, but I can't like get past the hump. And it's like, are you writing it down?
Yeah. Are you writing it down? Are you visualizing it?
Yeah.
Are you feeling what it would be like to actually have that, you know, manifest in your life?
Yeah. Yeah. To see it as a present moment, not as something that mm-hmm. will be or could be, but something that is. And
yeah,
and
having
right
gratitude
now.
For it,
yeah,
is very important too.
Yeah, and it's fascinating when you start digging into those things, because a lot of this, I've got my Ganesh over my shoulder over there. He takes mm-hmm. care of a lot of problems for me in the world, and a lot of this is taught in Eastern traditions. You know, when you start breaking apart things. In Indian tradition, stuff mm-hmm. like that, especially the ideas of karmic reincarnation, karma, that kind mm-hmm. of stuff. It's really interesting to see that, to see like how, yes, we may very well be bringing our energy back to this place because whatever we were supposed to do isn't done in that kind mm-hmm. of way.
Yeah, and I know I've heard some people, you know, say, yeah, as soon as, you know, we do transition, it's like, okay, when can we do it again?
Yeah.
And I was like, and we're here and we're going, oh God, there's no way I want to do this again. But then we see it from that different perspective, from, you know, one of those faster frequencies looking back. It's like, yeah, we want to do it again.
Yeah. Yeah.
We want to experience all the different aspects.
Yep. Yeah. Now, with that in mind, let's start getting into connecting with the angelic realm, Susan, because I mean, I'm sure for those that have not experienced NDE or had the traumatic experience that you have had, and I talk about it on the show all the time, whether it's a extreme paranormal experience, whether it is an mm-hmm. NDE, whether it's a case of abduction by craft or beings. Those things are something that shakes your system and shocks your system to such a point that it's like getting a magnet near a needle or near a watch mm-hmm. where that needle and watch is forever changed and somewhat vibrating the same way as that magnet is, you know, there's forever a connection. So, for those that haven't had that ecstatic experience of change mm-hmm. in their life in that kind of way, Susan. How can they begin to understand the angelic realm and connect with it for the messages that are intended for them?
Okay. The first thing I think would be to understand the difference between spirit guides and angels.
Okay, please. Let's start there.
Because an angel is and there's always exceptions to every single role, but it is extremely rare for an angel to have a physical lifetime.
Okay.
Where a spirit guide is just the opposite. It's extremely rare that they have not had a physical lifetime. So they do understand, like, when you have a situation that is, is related to, time in the 3D, like we experience, they understand that better. Because an angel's not ever, especially your personal ones, they've not experienced time, so they don't fully understand it.
Mm.
And one of the things that I have found that's kind of humorous, they also don't understand money, a lot of them. Our finances, because
I had
a conversation about this with one, and they actually was like, okay, you add a zero, which is a nothing behind it, and it makes it worth more.
Right? Yeah, no, it's pretty counterintuitive, man.
Yeah. As a general rule, like I said earlier, they're here to kind of help keep us on track. But sometimes that also can mean, giving us that clue before we're upside the head when we need it, because we're just not getting it.
Well, and that brings us to a question, because, of course, former seminarian for the Catholic Church. It's one of those, I will talk angels and spirits and things like that all day. And I'm very, very glad that you brought up the distinction between angel mm-hmm. and spirit guide. Because that's something that I have to tell people all the time is, people cannot, you can't go Gary Coleman and earn a pair of wings and a halo. No. That's not how that works. Okay. I know the movie was cool and I grew up with it too, but that's not how angel works. Mm-hmm. Like, it was a pre-existing hierarchy mm-hmm. before we came about, according to that mm-hmm. tradition. So the idea is that mm-hmm. yes, while we can proceed ahead of others and even come back and help them proceed forward themselves, angels play by a different set of rules than a spirit guide, number one, as we talk about all the time mm-hmm. whenever we're just talking demonology, things like mm-hmm. that to begin with. They play by a different set of rules than we do, much like djinn or people of the fey, that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But how much are they permitted to influence beyond free will?
Yeah. They need permission. So you asking for help is one of the most important things you can do. They can intervene, particularly if, like, I had a car accident last year that could have been turned out much differently than it did. And, I don't know what happened to my light here.
Oh, but, that's okay. You're fine.
They can intervene in those life-saving situations if you're not complete with, or your soul chooses not to leave yet. Because we are given different opportunities throughout our lifetime to exit.
Okay.
And our soul can, and even change its mind at the last minute. But, one of the other things that's also important to understand about angels is they do not leave during your lifetime. If there is any change in your guard, so to speak, that happens between lifetimes. And we all have one main guardian angel that's with you all of your lifetimes in physical form. And that isn't even restricted to lifetimes on Earth.
Oh, wow.
And like your spirit guides, your angels, as far as they typically go from you during it, is to maybe go ahead of you to make sure things happen or don't happen in your best and highest good. Sometimes you might have one of your angels say, stay home to protect and watch over your energy, space, your sacred space, your home.
Sure.
that that's usually as far as they go from you. Well, where your spirit guides, they can come and go as needed. You know, grandma can be a spirit guide, and she may only be a spirit guide for one day to help you through a certain situation.
Yeah. Yeah. And that is what I've heard from more than one person that does this type of work is that, and even to the point where like grandma can just take the day off. She can just be like, I'm tired of him still being stubborn and not listening to me, even when I'm dead, trying to help him, much less when I was alive and aggravated because he wouldn't listen. But
they also have their own things that they need to experience and things they need to, you know, like they had trauma in their physical lifetime. They need to go through a healing process.
Yeah. Yeah, precisely. Because it's not necessarily, and this doesn't preclude the fact that they are, and this is a differentiation that we've made numerous times on the show with paranormal investigators, is that different between spirit and ghost. That idea of one of them being trapped without knowing something has happened, and the other willingly being there. Whether it's the fact of like, no, Judy hasn't let me go yet, so I can't let Judy go. You know, that kind of stuff. And there's some of that that like they may still be processing what they were supposed to process before they passed. But that doesn't mean that even if they move on to the light, that they cannot come back to assist you.
Right. And because you perceive them as grandma, they're always going to appear that way, even though they've, you know, had other lifetimes of in playing different roles.
Sure.
Because that's how you connect to them energetically.
Yeah. And from the time of their passing to the present time, I mean, they may have had numerous lifetimes in that amount of time because once again, they have passed beyond the physical bounds of what we know as time and define as time. So, And that even goes to speak for just the actual state of existence for the angelic realm itself, as opposed to, because I would at least pose the fact that while the two may commingle as far as vibrational realm of spirit guide and angelic guide and angels, I would not say that they are necessarily the same realm. In that kind of way, like is that the fact that just be me positing it? But
and no, I think they exist in a different frequency,
shifted differently from each other.
Right.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think because they've had a physical form. You know, spirit guides have had a physical lifetime. I think they're still functioning in a little bit slower frequency than the angelics function in.
Okay. Okay.
And there's even different groups of angels, like the ones that are our personal angels function have slowed their frequency down a little bit to be able to interact with us.
No.
Where there's certain, archangels, you know, like everybody wants to think that, you know, Archangel Michael is their personal angel. Mm. No, there may be somebody from, that he oversees that is, part of your team. But, archangels are also one of those that are going to come and go as they're needed or called upon.
Okay.
And that's how, and because, like you mentioned earlier, that there is really no such thing as time. That's why they can be with what we perceive as with multiple people at the same time.
Yeah, what we would perceive as, quote, bilocation, being in more than one location at the same time.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. And that fractured understanding of time is what allows them to be in a fractured location like that. Now, with that in mind, is it the fact that with consent, especially because like you said, they can't help, at least angelically, they can't help without consent. I would posit the fact that your spirit guide, things like that are forever, and even angels are forever throwing hurdles in the path and digging potholes in the path that you ain't supposed to go down. You know, like that's just like what they tend to do in my mind. But that does mm-hmm. not, once again, doing so does not change your free will. Like, you want to go down right. that rough potted road, you can go down it all day. You want to keep tripping over tripping over hurdles that they're throwing in your way, you can do that. That's your decision. But if I choose to obstinately not listen to my guides and my angelic guides that are there, Susan, how are you able to listen to them for me? And that kind of, because I've denied the consent of their help and haven't asked for their help or haven't acknowledged their attempt for help. Can they route past me in that consent kind of way to somebody like you who can kind of see them anyway?
On occasion, yes.
Okay.
I know, especially when I'm doing private sessions with people where I'm drawing one of their personal angels for them. If the angels convey any messages for me, to me, you know, I will convey that to people.
Okay.
But they can also be like people, you know, how some of us are just more sure. talkative than others.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And sometimes they've been a little frustrated because it's been so long since you listened to them that, it takes them a while to open up. But, you know, one of the things that I have encountered from feedback from people that I have done an angel portrait for, the drawing almost works like a portal to make the communication. It opens the door.
Okay.
Some people have flat out referred to them as portals.
Now, granted, I will posit the fact for that yes, at that point, if I have come to you for a session mm-hmm. or come to you for a portrait, that is absolutely my point of consent of, I know something's there, but I don't know how to contact it. Please help me. So yeah, I can utterly see how they would come to you at that point. But is it the fact that, like, if I am utterly obstinate, I'm not even looking up your website. I'm not looking for that. I'm not listening to anybody. Mm-hmm. Do they still come to you with message for that person?
Without permission.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And once in a while, I do once in a while get inklings from somebody when sure. I'm, say, in the grocery store, but because I don't have permission, I don't. I did one time and I regretted it because that person wasn't ready to hear the message.
I ask specifically because it's something that I ask of mediums. It's something that I ask even of precogs and the remote viewing community, which I'm a part of, you know, and that is the idea of, do you get to a point of being so open that the floodgates A can't be stopped, or that B, you get to a point of, oh, hey, wait a minute. Like, I'm in that dude's private thoughts right now and I'm not even trying to be so, you know, without their consent. I was just curious if it was the fact of, like, the angels could, like, literally shoot flares up for you to see. But without that point of consent from me, like you said, the person isn't ready, much like any addict. You could go mm-hmm. through 85 interventions a week until they are ready to stop. And make mm-hmm. that decision of, like, whoa, man, this is out of pocket. I need to stop. Until mm-hmm. that happens, like, have fun with the interventions, you know. Mm-hmm. And do you ever get the message for? Because I'm sure, once again, that grandma gets very tired of people's business, like the same way she got tired of people's business every Christmas whenever they came to visit. God love them as much as she loved them. I'm sure that she gets just as tired of their antics and foolishness in the afterlife. But what about our angelic guides?
They can, you know, what we refer to as saints that have the patience of Job. Yeah, most of them do. Do they get frustrated with us? Sometimes, yeah, they do. Because, like, yeah, and that's why sometimes we end up feeling like we got the 2x4 upside the head. Because it's like, they're trying desperately, because each time, you know, they put, say, an opportunity to learn a lesson or, you know, for some sort of growth in front of you, it's like the first time it's pretty easy.
Mm.
The next time, if you didn't get it, it's a little more difficult and a little more difficult until you finally get it.
I have said that just as somebody who, once again, spent time in the seminary, studied numerous spiritual mm-hmm. paths, spent years as an assistant youth minister mm-hmm. teaching confirmation, things like that. That is something that I tried to impress upon every student I ever had, was the fact of, number one, you are never finished. The day you stop right. asking questions, you should stop drawing breath. And mm-hmm. and that's about your faith, the basis of your faith, why you believe what you believe, what you hold dear, everything.
Mm-hmm.
You should be growing in that way every day, or trying to.
Growing and learning and expanding in some way.
Yeah.
Now, finding a way to, you know, go within and understand on a deeper level who you personally, you actually are.
Yeah. Yeah, no, exactly. Exactly. And what your connection to the rest of it is, because, mm-hmm. you know, once again, I was explaining this to a niece of mine not too long ago about her mother who passed. And that's that, number one, you can never unring a bell. You can never unring a bell. Once the sound of your chord and your note, your distinct vibration begins in the universe, it will never unsound. You mm-hmm. you are forever ringing in the cosmos, and all that will happen is eventually you will shed this part as well, and you will, your note will join theirs in a beautiful resounding chord in the universe that is resonant and more resonant than just your solo note alone. You know, mm-hmm. so it, like that goes beyond a religious teaching. That's like actual physics, man. And when you start thinking about that in terms of, once again, angelic vibration, a different dimensionality in that kind of mm-hmm. way, and how we can reach that. Like I am a huge user of crystals. I'm always surrounded by them. I have a few that sit on my desk that are specifically angelic realm crystals. My selenite tower that sits next to me, as well as a few large pieces of bismuth. Bismuth has been one that is just, I've been fascinated by it since I was about 15 years old, and it was one of the things that really drew me to studying the way that these crystals and minerals actively help increase that vibration. And it's fascinating when you start looking at those things. What other means can the average person use to help pick their vibration up, to maybe start tuning into that angelic message, if that mm-hmm. is not even if it's surrounding them, but is surrounding them and like literally trying to knock the door down to get in?
Yeah, I think another way, you know, is doing things like, I know you create by and your beat music. Mm. That can be, music in general can be helpful.
Yeah.
But I particularly would be very careful about the frequency of the music you listen to.
Yes.
Particularly try and find that music that is using the South Asia frequencies. Because those are the frequencies used to sing our universe into existence and can help us realign with our original blueprint.
Mm.
And there's 81 different Salvagio frequencies. You know, there are also whole tone frequencies that can be very helpful,
yeah.
which don't, you know, because the Salvagio music, you know, tuning as you were based on Pythagorean math. And, you know, and all those numbers, they always add up to that 3, 6, or 9.
Yep.
Whole tones don't work within Pythagorean math, but they do still always add up to the 3, 6, 9.
Interesting. Interesting.
And, yeah, and you know, because you saw them when I was when we originally met in Las Vegas, the mandalas that I've created on based on all the different South Asia frequencies.
Yes. Yes. And the artwork on that is absolutely mm-hmm. awesome. I was just bringing up the, just going to your website and bringing up the Solfeggio Mandala decks because it.
Yeah, that's. Mm-hmm.
It's one of those. I am not a tarot user for scrying.
Mm-hmm.
I do not use tarot for scrying the future in any kind of way or anything like that. I use tarot as a daily meditation. I draw a single card and mm-hmm. I look at the meaning of the imagery of that card and the meaning of that card traditionally and how, you know, basically how I should look for that in my day to day, you know, just giving me mm-hmm. a different lens by which to look at my day. Mm-hmm. not in any kind of like, am I going to meet the woman of my dreams, which has already happened, honey, if you're listening out there in the living room, not for anything like that. Or like, you know, trying to find mm-hmm. pick winning lotto numbers. Mm-hmm. So the idea of the Solfeggio cards, I loved the idea of like, yes, this mm-hmm. is the frequency of meditation that you need to think about today.
Yeah, because, you know, and I use them like pull a card for the day going, you know, what frequency will support me through the energies of today or the week or the month or the year? You can, you know, use them to put them, say, under your glass of water or under your dinner plate to help charge the food.
Ooh, interesting. Yeah.
You can use them in all kinds of ways. Yeah. I have even made a few stickers that, you know, of some of them that I'll put on like a water bottle, even on the back of my car.
Well, and it, you know, it brings up something very important that whenever I speak at conferences about binaural beats, whenever I speak on shows about binaural beats, that kind of stuff, It's the idea that frequency is more than just a sound and a color. It is a thought form. It's a literal mm-hmm. thought form. It is how often are you thinking something?
Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, and what frequency is that thought at?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and, you know, if you don't know what to do, it's something super simple. Is just think of something you're grateful for. That can help raise your frequency fairly quickly.
Yep.
Yeah, even if it's just the fact that you've got air conditioning or heat or running water.
Yeah.
Yeah. A roof over your head, that you're grateful for some, you know, those things that we all have, you know, most of us have, you know.
Yep.
In our day-to-day lives.
Yeah. No, and you know, one of the things that I came up with years ago was my thankful nine. And that was a 9 minute a day meditation that was so simple that it was broken up into three minute meditations throughout the day. Mm. So it was, you wake up in the morning and you think of three things that you are grateful for, three things that you are absolutely happy for in the universe and in the world. And halfway through the day, you think about each one for a minute. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
Just think about that one thing for a minute. Then halfway through the day, you think about ways that you are loved in the world. Three ways that you're loved in the world.
That's a good one.
You know, whether it's my dog loves me. He is so happy to see me every day that I walk through that door. Doesn't matter what it is. Three ways mm-hmm. that you're loved and appreciated in the world. And then the last one is three ways that you can love and appreciate more in the world. In the evening. So in something as mm-hmm. simple as that, where it's like, the example I used to give my kids, granted, I don't go to mass a whole lot anymore, mm-hmm. but I would literally bring a sack of pennies that equaled up to the number of hours in a week. And I'd give it to a mm-hmm. kid and I'd go, if you had this many pennies and I asked you for one, would you be willing to give me one? You know? So it's like, if you have like mm-hmm. 174 pennies, would you be willing to live with 173 and give me mm-hmm. one? Because if you can give me one, then that means you can give back to the universe that is giving to you.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't, it doesn't take a lot.
That's a really cool way to look at it.
It doesn't take a lot, but it's the fact of if you hold the slinky, it does nothing till you push it.
Mm-hmm.
The the angels are going to do nothing till you scream their name and scream out, help me. They mm-hmm. can't, you know, and I have posited numerous times on this show in the last year or so, Susan, that when it comes to that taking the name of God in vain, that is one of the like main sins in mm-hmm. Judeo-Christianity, that it's not what we consider like, you know, using it in a curse word kind of way. It's because mm-hmm. by all actual law in Kabbalah, things like that, because we were breathed into by the Creator, we uniquely have the means of creation inside of us vibrationally. So mm-hmm. there's 90% of things in the universe that we can fully handle ourselves. And he wants us to call our name. The angels want us to call their name when we actually need them. Not at a moment where we don't actively need them, where we could solve the situation ourselves. Because then what's the lesson being learned, you know, mm-hmm. as far as soul work goes? It's the fact of when you're needlessly calling, when you're crying wolf, so to speak, to the mm-hmm. universe, that's taking the name of God in vain, because like he's got real yeah. things to do in the cosmos, man. And if it's something that you can utterly handle on your own, you probably should, you know, like any good parent enables their child to be able to make their own toast, you know, because mm-hmm. otherwise you may be making toast all day, man, and you got real things to do in the world.
But I just find it interesting that you mentioned the Kabbalah because of my most recent project that I okay. just released.
Oh, what is that all about?
It's the, my camera. It's the 72 angels from the Kabbalah.
Oh,
I created
wow.
a deck of.
Wow. Awesome. Is that mm-hmm. this one right here?
Yes. Yeah.
That is incredible mm-hmm. and awesome. Let's get into that for yeah. a minute, because it really is one of those, when you start studying that and understanding, once again, your place within things, but also mm-hmm. the fact that while you're a digit in the chain of numbers in the universe, that you cannot exist without the number one. You know, mm-hmm. like that's one of the most beautiful Kabbalistic principles in the world, just for the mm-hmm. proof of the existence of God, is no other number can exist without one. God is one.
Yeah, I know. I'm still learning the Kabbalah myself, but, you know, connecting with the angels from the Kabbalah yeah. for me was, you know, was easy. And it just, yeah, it just kind of made sense for me to jump in and do that. You
wow,
know?
That is beautiful and amazing. And, you know,
yeah,
once...
And it's, you know, what's unique is, you know, I did put, you know, like their name in the, you know, in Jewish, you know, is yep. here. This is referred to as the ancient angelic, you know, seal.
Yep.
That goes, you know, goes back, you know, maybe even as far back as Solomon.
It, exactly.
You know, the one in the, yeah, the one in the top right is the modern sigil.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, there have been numerous things, everything from not just the seals of Solomon, which have numerous angelic writings, stuff like that, but the work D, back in the, that's where we got a lot of angelic script from, was the work of John mm-hmm. D, that kind of stuff. And mm-hmm. when you start looking at these things, once again, the idea of, because the Kabbalah is thick, Susan, it's one of those, like, I made my way through it because the things that I read in college and the seminary were things that, like, our required reading was like Plato's Republic and, you know, apologetics mm-hmm. of St. Thomas Aquinas, things like that, where it's like, no, there's an actual formula to reading the way it's written. And it's mm-hmm. weird. But it's one of those, you learn to look at things in a very instruction manual kind of way when that's what you're used to reading. So mm-hmm. for average people, it's not something that you can just get through. It's very, very thick, full of a lot of mm-hmm. things that you technically have to know before you start down the path, you know, mm-hmm. Because it's one of those, like, it, the needing to know it was part of the apprenticeship of learning it, you know, as far as mystery school, things like that went. So the fact that you are breaking these down into such an easy to understand, because once again, this is stuff that even if you went into the greater lesser key of Solomon and started looking at Michael the angel and, you know, how to talk to him, what his powers are, what he's about, everything else, it is way more complex than what you have here. So this gives people a very good and easy understanding to move forward with that relationship instead of the complexity of what most people would be would consider technical and utilitarian literal magic to understand and to get to.
Yeah, the angels want so much to help us with our growth and our expansion that, you know, any tool that we have that can help us, you know, on a human level that makes it easy and gets down to the core of it without making it complicated. I know my friends tease me once in a while where, like, I went to this lecture and it lasted, you know, like 45 minutes. And at the end, I said one sentence that said everything that man had said in 45 minutes. I have a way of doing that.
And that's just it. When you start getting it, because these things can be very hard when it comes to discernment, which is what a lot of mediumship. And I don't necessarily want to put what you're doing in the realm of mediumship. I think it's a little bit different than standard mediumship, simply because of your actual relationship with them. However, when you're doing that, it can be hard for the average person to understand what that connection is, you know, and how to make, once again, how to make that connection, how to be open to that connection. Because it's sadly a whole lot simpler than most people think. Like you said, all you have to do is actively ask. But at that point, you have to have the discernment, much like with prayer, to be able to spot when your prayer has been answered, you know, and sometimes that can be hard because the answer may have been no. The answer straight up may have been no from the universe and from your angelic guides and from the capital C creator of the universe, the prime mover, because that is not what's best for you, despite your own desire and despite your own want. So,
because the worst thing that could happen to a lot of us is to win the lottery.
Exactly.
But it's the one thing we all ask for.
Well, and it's also the fact of, once again, they play by a different set of, well, I'm not saying that angels are going around like djinn or genies, where they play by a set of nefarious rules where it's like, I want 1,000 pounds of gold, and like 1,000 pounds of gold falls out of an airplane on you. You know, well, you got your 1,000 pounds of gold, buddy. There you go. Like, you don't have to necessarily be so specific with your angelic guides. I think they understand what your question is in a greater sense of your want, and also whether or not, once again, the prime mover in the universe says you're supposed to vibrate in that direction anyway.
But I have also found that if you stand there and go, I don't want this, or this or this, then they don't necessarily always hear that word don't. And you might end up with exactly what you said you didn't want.
Yeah.
So, you know, say it in a positive way. You know, I intend to manifest this in my life. I am grateful that this is coming my way. Whatever. You know, don't focus, you know, as if you're focusing on it in any way of lack.
Yes. Yes.
Then that's, you know, you're cutting off the energy right there.
Exactly. You have put down a wet foundation to start putting bricks on for the wall is exactly what's happened.
If you want to understand that kind of prayer technique, I recommend Greg Braden's book on the Isaiah scroll.
Okay. And honestly, that is one of my favorite things about your website is you're like me. You have a resources page where it's like, oh, no, no, no. Like, you want some help. You want some data. Here's some places to go get it. And I am all about that because it's one of those, it shouldn't be locked. That kind of stuff should not be locked behind paywall. You know, that's right. How you can tell a good spiritual teacher and things like that is that they're willing to give you the majority of things.
Yeah.
And your work is once again absolutely awesome. The artwork
Thank
that
you.
You generate is more than beautiful and stirring and moving. I know the vibration in my studio is 100% different since I put your artwork in it. How can people schedule sessions with you, and how do you go about presenting that person's specific angel or angelic message into the artwork that you create for them?
You can just find me on my website, SusanWalterArt.com. There is a button there at the top that says something like, you know, schedule your session. Yeah. And yeah, the drawings are very similar to what's, you know, on the cards. The main message isn't always, you know, things that they might tell me, but one, if you look real closely, you know, and I know it's some of these cards, you see down the very center, usually starting about the throat, there is angelic light language. That language is like, it's in light language, at least to me, it's not a language of words. It's a language of energy.
Okay.
So that light language that's written on the body is like a gift of energy that they're, you know, from them to you.
Interesting.
And I think that is one of the most, that energetic connection is one of the most profound gifts that come with the angel portraits. And I haven't always done that. They didn't start showing me, I think it's probably about 6 years ago now, approximately, that they started showing me that light language, you know, on the body of the angel.
Wow. Wow. And how has that interpreted for you? Because once again, you've been having these visitations with these angels, specifically your personal angels. Since the age of 4 and 6.
Yeah.
So what do you think that means with the new form of communication in that way, Susan?
I think it has, you know, a lot about, you know, the love and respect that they have for us.
Mm.
Yeah. And I think it's that simple.
Okay.
Yeah, and it, you know, it can be some sort of energetic support for you, you know, at this stage of your growth.
Interesting. And that's what I was going to say, especially, you know, at this point in your growth path with them and communication with them, the fact that, yes, you know, you have stepped into a new realm and new vibration of working with them, which is, you know, once again, kind of their show of respect to you, the fact that there is a new form of communication that is more in depth and gives you a different realm of insight that you different than what you had previously, which was still intense and immense. So,
yeah,
that is beautiful to know that you're still growing in that connection with them.
Yeah, it's changed and influenced my whole life. And I think if we let them, it can do that for all of us, even if we don't physically see them like I do.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, with that in mind, these things can be burdensome. They can be hard, even if you've chosen the road that you have as counselor and conduit for these things. Would you ever stop it? If you had the chance, Susan, would you ever call a woe horsey to the ride that you're on with it and the connection you have? No?
Mm-mm. Nope.
That's...
I'll probably, you know, be connecting with them and doing this in some way as long as I can hold a pencil or a paintbrush in my hand.
that's beautiful to hear. I just as an artist myself, it's one of those. And some of those things are getting hard for me. Like I'm getting ready to go to the doctor right now for my hands because I can play maybe 15 minutes of guitar nowadays. And that in and of itself hurts me, much less the actual pain after playing. And it's one of those, like, that has fed my soul in a different way throughout my life, you know, and even my connection to my music has changed over the years. Mm-hmm. So yeah. And I have always said, like, this, what you see over my left shoulder, people, is my hearth. I am a firm believer in the muse and in the fact that if you want these angel visitors to be happy, if you want your muse to be happy, give them a hearth, give them a home, give them a place where which they can come, where they can wait patiently for you to be ready and is comfortable and beautiful for them, full of things that they like, because otherwise you're doing them a disservice, kind of making them hang around your funk while you're waiting to get in mode, you know? And that's what I tell people all the time. And they're like, my God, this is all just set up. I'm like, yeah, so I can turn it on and just hit record and start doing things. Because otherwise I've literally called my muse in and said, let's play. And then once they're there and tweaked out and ready, I'm like, wait, I got like an hour to set things up and make sure it's all right. And then we can play. Okay. Just hold on. And that's not fair. That's like energetically, that's not a fair exchange to the universe that you're trying to inspire and move, you know, you've just like thrown an albatross around the neck of your angel at that point, artistically. So yeah, the idea of having a space, having that place, not only in your heart, but in your home and in your physical space to invite them there, I think is hugely important.
It's important for any of us to find, whether it's music or art or knitting or whatever, you know, creative outlet. I do knit, but, you know, and I find it very meditative. So that opens me up to allow, you know, sometimes that's when I receive some of the best messages.
Yeah. No, and that's just it, because your mind is literally in a different state at that point. You're resonating at a different state. And at that point you don't have your preconceived notions up. You don't have your wall of communication where you've been having a conversation the whole way to the table, answering the questions in the other person's voice. Those things aren't in place at that point. You know, so it comes in beautiful moments of inspiration and connection. And it is something that, you've got to mind the frequency in your mind and the way in which you are connected to the world around you like that. So,
find a way to reset your frequency, whether it's with the mandalas or listening to different frequencies. And I know one of the things, you know, sometimes even if you don't want to hear that music for some reason, just turn the volume down. It's still going to affect the energy of your space.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, I could not have said that better. It's the fact of the all around intention, you know, and it's the fact of the person that doesn't want to be hypnotized will never be hypnotized. You'll never be hypnotized as long as you say it's impossible to be so, or I don't want to be. As long as those two things are forefront in your mind, it will never occur. That is an absolute static fact. So I want to thank you for this conversation tonight, Susan. My fingertips are all a tingle, which is normally how I know the conversation went somewhere. It's been amazing. I want to have you on again and again, because these are the conversations I think are hugely important in our society right now, not just as people and humans, but as a global community, you know, like we're getting into with our next guest, the idea of how do we begin a global conversation that can resonate into the cosmos? How do we, like, if we can't even agree on what to teach in kindergarten, much less and the UN, how are we going to have a conversation on a cosmic level? You know, and that that's what we have to prepare ourselves for all the way around.
Yeah, and very, very quickly.
Yeah, and this, I think, is a huge step to that understanding that we are quantumly connected to this stuff in a different way, in a totally different way than just physicality and what it says in a bunch of gold leaf papers.
Yeah, you know, what we see with our physical eyes is only a fraction of what is going on in the world around us.
Absolutely. Susan, thank you once again for your very open heart and candid conversation tonight. Before we let you go, let everybody know where they can go to schedule a session with you, where they can go to get their own angelic portrait done, where they can go to get your artwork and your amazing card series for meditation.
You can find all that on my website, SusanWalterArt.com, and you can see at the top there is on the screen that I do. I'm on Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, and I just started posting on TikTok as well.
Ooh, all right. Fantastic. Well, once again, thank you so much. It's been great catching up with you. It was so beautiful the day that you reached out, and I was like, oh, my God. Susan, that's great. So I'm excited to have you back in the roster. And I guarantee you it will not be the last time you are on the show. I reach out to people at random times about things. So I look forward to that. You take care. You have a great evening. I'll be in touch with links for the show, everything else. Have a great evening, Susan. Wow.
Bye-bye, everyone.
Bye-bye. Man, what an amazing conversation with Susan Walter, folks. And once again, that the idea of how do we begin our work? You know, there's a reason, and it's not for conspiracy theory reasons or Masonic reasons. I guess maybe it's kind of Masonic. The reason why we have this little unfinished pyramid that I'm pointing at here is our logo. That is an esoteric symbol, meaning that you are never finished. The work is never finished. The work on you is never finished. You are forever an unfinished temple, my friends. So remember, no matter what fire happens in your temple, you can rebuild the temple, because you're never finished. The journey's never finished. So it's a beautiful concept when you think about that, when you stop, when you think about that, and the fact that you have a chance to reinvent yourself throughout your whole life. And if you decide tonight, I hope you decide, but if you wait till tomorrow morning to say yes and get connected with your spirit guides, with your angelic guides, I hope you take the time to do so. When we come back from this quick commercial break, everybody, we will be joined by our good friend, Keith Seeland, author of the Humaniverse series of books. We will be talking about that all-important conversation of, is humanity ready for a cosmic conversation? Are we evolved enough as a species to be able to get along to have that conversation? Can we agree what that conversation should be? And where does 3i Atlas fall into that conversation as a greater part of things, as a part of what's moving the conversation right now, and how we are catalyzed into possible fear doctrines, things like that from it? We'll be getting into that and so much more right after that quick commercial break with our friend Keith Seeland, right after this, folks.
The key to good science is good research. At the heart of good research is a good data set. With the Field Observation and Encounter Log from Curious Research, you can easily keep track of your investigative information all in one place, making it easier to review cases and readily see comparisons and contrasts between them. Whether out in the woods squatching, in a back room gathering EVPs, or using high-tech gear to track UFO-UAP activity, this easy-to-carry, pocket-sized scientific data log is the perfect companion for any field researcher. You can find your copy of the Curious Research Field Observation and Encounter Log at Amazon.com or visit the official Curious Realm store at CuriousRealm.com/store to reserve your copy for yourself, your family, or a mind that you want to open. That website again is CuriousRealm.com/store.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome back from that quick commercial break. Thank you so much to our guest in that first segment, Susan Walters. We got a chance to meet her at Stairway to the Stars a couple years ago. It was a great conversation. I've had her art hanging in my studio since. And speaking of things that are in my studio regularly, True Hemp Science, everybody. If you're a user of CBD products like I am, stop on by TrueHempScience.com. They are your website to find amazing products made by Christopher Lynch and his staff over there. They use a spigeric process using every part of the plant, leaves, stems, roots, buds, flowers. Every part is used, reused, combusted, and reused to make an amazing spigeric product complete with terpene profiles and all. Stop on by. Check them out. True Hemp Science is the website that you want to go to. Curious7 is the code that you want to use to save 7% off your entire cart of $50 or more and get two edibles on your way out the door. While you're online, make sure to stop on by the website of our guest for this segment. TheHumaniverse.org is the website of our good friend and guest, Keith Seeland. The Humaniverse is a series of books. He's got a new book coming out soon. And the whole concept behind Keith's work is humanity ready to have the greater conversation cosmically? Are we in a place as a species to have the cosmic conversation with our neighbors? Should they choose to ring the bell? You know, Keith, I choose to believe the fact that they've rung the bell. They've been here for a while, but that's just personal belief. But welcome back to the show, sure. Keith. How have you been doing?
Great, Chris. Thank you. As it's always a pleasure for me to be able to sit down and have your audience talk about our future as a species, as a society, and our future with ET.
Well, and you know, our future with ET is a fascinating topic, and one of those that I think is one of the real, not only physics thought experiments, but sociological thought experiments out there. You know, how do we prepare ourselves for conversation on a greater scale? The conversation we've had numerous times on this show with other people, as well as you, every time we've had you on, Keith, is, you know, like we can barely agree on what's supposed to be taught in a classroom, state by state, much less agree on things in a countrywide or a global scale as humanity. So how are we going to have the conversation outside of humanity? You know, how do we shift the consciousness to that being the most pertinent thing? How did you get into this field of study to begin with, Keith? What brought you to questioning this? And it's interesting because exopolitics is something that has really popped up in the last decade. And I'm happy for that because it's a big question that we need to start asking ourselves as a people.
Yeah, Chris. I think this whole meta subject of our future with other intelligent species from elsewhere, this whole subject, when you talk about factors involved in trying to move forward with it, I believe, and that's been the thrust of my work up to now, building up to now, currently and into the future, is to where the most important factor or accomplishment that I think we will learn and derive from all of this study is learning about ourselves. I mean, we are, how will I put this? We are going to be, when the intelligent extraterrestrial manifestation takes place, we're going to be presumably on the flip side of what we've come to know about other human contacts, such as I'll title this the Columbus syndrome. In other words, those contacts between the Spaniards, Columbus, and San Sanibel, the natives there, or between the Spaniards and Native America, they involved both parties were human beings, the explorers and the recipients of that. The one big difference is going to be that presumably the explorers are going to be the extraterrestrial intelligences. We'll, as humans, be the recipients of it. So while there was an awful lot to have been learned between Columbus and the natives in San Sanibel, or the Spaniards and Native America, it's between us and ET, and there's going to be even that much more of a learning curve. Important factor involved in this is that humans have, I believe, currently right now, and this is an accomplishment for us and promotes optimism, that we have the intelligence to be able to proactively study all these phenomena and the meta subjects that is intelligent life in the universe besides us. So we have probably the most important tool is that the intelligence that we possess in order to be able to study and help effectively prepare for that. Now, in translation to our society as it works and as it operates today, how I put this, you just mentioned it's been a highly individualized in your preface, saying that we can't agree on the state level how to teach our youngsters, our students, our young people. We can't seem to agree on much of anything. In a sociopolitical aspect, my last count was there 235 different political governments throughout our civilization. It's fractured. I mean, and here I'm not trying in any way to be a proponent for a world government, a world society, or whatever. Absolutely not. This is coming down more to the individual level in terms of helping us to prepare a plan of action proactively, as I'm strongly promoting, for the eventual, even so much the acknowledgement that ET exists, because many in this community are well past that. There's three dimensions to any kind of a future with an ET and an ET intelligence. That is the first is the acknowledgement that they exist. Second is the contact, the globally acknowledged and agreed upon, undeniable first contact.
Yeah.
And then there's the biggest learning curve, which is going to be the purposes of that particular contact with ET. Yeah. So our society has struggled mightily with all of that. And it has become an extreme example of parochialism in that it seems that the only aspects, the only divisions, or the only compartments of our society that are being allowed to study anything to do with this phenomenon include the government, scientists, and the military, period.
Yeah.
Our culture is made up of many, many different aspects, such as the sciences, such as governing industry, trade, commerce. There's going to be presumably legal aspects in the astro studies of other civilizations, extraterrestrials and whatnot. Then we also have, as part of our culture, the arts, the humanities. These are all of the occupations that make up what I call our human condition. And my call is for to have not a parochial representation of just a government think tank or a laboratory science think tank or a military think tank. And it's a need for involvement from all aspects of our society to make the preparations for the acknowledgments, not only that, but the contacts and the purposes, the future relationships from that. It's a lot more than just weaponizing and all of that. And this is a very complex subject, so there's going to be a lot of webs involved, a lot of trees and interface with all of this. So a lot to dive into. But the biggest takeaway, I think, is that in studying and preparing for all of this, we are going to learn more about ourselves as a species than any other subject scenario that I think we'll ever undertake.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's one of those, once again, even as a thought experiment, Keith, it's I think, one of the most important thought experiments going on with humanity. I was just popping up the article for the listeners out there from CBS back in 2011 about the possible ambassador to alien civilizations from the UN, and that basically the Office of Space Affairs at the UN was stepping in, and that undersecretary who's in charge of whatever that office is, mainly tracks space debris and things like that for international space use. But the idea that it would pass through a UN panel first, any major contact. And being a child of the 80s, I, of course, remember the famous quote from Ronald Reagan of how fast will our world differences disappear if we were contacted from something outside. You know, and a lot of people have, there have been hype, you've been to the conferences, I've been to the conferences, Keith, you know, there's a large cadre of people out there that firmly believe that we have met with aliens, that they have landed at Air Force bases, that we have drawn up contracts with them. Some people even believe that, you know, alien abduction is partially because of those contracts. It's fascinating to see the rabbit holes that are dug when it comes to the idea of alien contact and whether or not we have been contacted and what would happen to our modern society if we found out that we were contacted, you know. And I choose, I mean, right over your left shoulder there is the famed spaceman from Nazca. Thank you. I was to die. Peru was in my head, but Nazca just left.
Yeah,
it's one of those when you look at things like that, it's a fascinating image. And it is one of those. Now, granted, many of there was the study a couple years ago. I want to say it was from Harvard that noted that quite a few of the Nazca lines are actually basically like a water map to help people find water for sacred sites, things like that, in the desert, which is fascinating. But that wasn't all of them. It was only a few of them, like the hummingbird and things like that. When it comes to the spaceman, there's still a lot of conjecture. There's still a lot of hearsay. And there's still a lot right now of other petroglyphs or other geoglyphs. Sorry, not petroglyphs. It's a very important distinction. Petroglyphs occur on rock faces, things like that. Geoglyphs occur on a scale that you cannot see without scale. You have to be a massive distance away to be able to see them on the scale that they are. It's not like rock art on the inside of a cave. Geoglyphs are different. They are on a grand, huge scale. like the one over your shoulder, which is miles long. Even looking at the fact of there have been numerous things like that found recently. How do we get to a point of A, understanding that communication from our elders, from elder societies that have been around, who have the stories? I choose to look at science, and even part of Curious Research's mission is to get science to re-understand that it begins with observation. It begins with a story. You know, like if this culture in the region has this story that is protracted and progenerated for so many generations unchanged, that story and that observation means something. So can we marry even that observation? And the example that I'll give is things like the Lowland Gorilla, you know, where Anglos weren't interested in that for a long time. It was a story told by the natives there where we came and colonized and things like that. But even until Anglo scientists got the interest of, well, let's check out this story. It took 85 years from the time of their interest to the time of discovery, you know? So are we even interested? Are we interested in the right stories from these civilizations that have existed before us and that still have remnants around now? And can we make those messages stand out to humanity in such a way that they are relevant in a modern society? You know?
And maybe this is one small point that I got here, Chris.
Please.
In relation to the larger, much larger picture. Mm-hmm. You brought up a point about how particular science, so to speak, does their studying and research and provides society with information and discovery and knowledge and things like that. And the parochialism that I mentioned a minute ago. Science has a couple of different components to it. There's a laboratory component that allows for the accumulation of data and its analysis through experimentation and following through on hypotheses and making conclusions and then revisiting those. Thank you for that. Yep, there's the steps in the scientific methodology. Well, there's another big division of science that's not laboratory per se, but what I'll call the forensics. And those are all the other duties involved with potential testimony and abstract thinking and whatnot. And in the strategies that debunkers often use is that in studying the ET UFO phenomenon, UAP phenomenon, in that, well, it's not testable. Well, testability is a very, very vital and necessary part of laboratory science. Whereas the forensics cover all of the other areas of scientific investigation, the Sherlock Holmes aspect, so to speak. And that ties in with the parochialism of the grander subject of studying the potentials or trying to decide whether extraterrestrials do exist or not. And the parochialism is that the science communities, mostly the laboratory scientists, are cohorts with the government who pays their paychecks. And then you've got the military as the omnipresent overseer, so to speak, in that it's been that's a reflection of the most basal aspects of the human condition, human behavior, in that the competitive and the warlike nature that is part of our human nature and our human condition, that was ingrained into our basal brains millions of years ago in previous versions of the human being hominids.
Yeah, that's just part of survival.
Exactly, exactly. But the good thing is our intelligence, as I mentioned, are the most important and under-tapped aspect of this whole subject of trying to determine and plan our futures with ET, is that we've got the intelligence. We are aware of all of these potential pitfalls and opportunities and whatnot. It's up to us to take advantage of all of those opportunities.
Yeah.
And that's where I think the parochialism of the government and the laboratory science cohorts are doing a great disservice to us.
I would tend to agree.
Yeah, you mentioned a minute ago about the United Nations and their UFO office. That was created, I believe, back in the 1978, around the time when J. Allen Hynek did appear before the UN General Council, I believe it was in October of that year, as a support for the testimony of Sir Eric Geary of Grenada, Prime Minister there, and his discussions about his family and his court having ET experiences, craft landing, UAPs, the whole phenomenon. They experienced all of that. The United Nations did create a UFO office a couple of months after that. Unfortunately, it gained no traction in that the sociopolitical aspects reared their ugly heads, in that Grenada was over, the government was overthrown in a political coup. So the United Nations mothballed, but still kept that UFO office, how I put this, physically present, but not actively open or whatever.
Yeah.
Fast forward, my friend Gary Heseltine, a few years ago, him and some other ambassadors, Donald Schmidt, for one, is the North American ambassador. I believe he still is. They enacted Project Titan, which is designed currently to get back to the UN and compel them to open up that UFO office. And as the world's premier collection point of representatives from all the socio-political governments, be able to make decisions about the operation and the future of our planet. So you, if you take that idea, the United Nations idea, and you help to promote and write into a plan of action, proactively speaking, for not only the acknowledgement of ET, but the contact and the future purposes, such as now that we acknowledge that ET exists, now that we've made this contact, what's the purpose of this budding relationship? Is it going to be economic? Is it going to be cultural? Is it going to be military? Is it going to be educational? Is it going to be biological, existential? All those potential features of a course of future relationship with ET will come up. And currently, we can't agree as individual governments on much of anything. Again, everything to do with the ET has been weaponized and has become so secret. The United Nations idea represents a potential to where all the representatives of humankind can come together and potentially include, and this is what I advocate, all of the multidimensional, the institutions that make up our human our culture, our human nature, and our human conditions, the business, the economics, the legal, yes, the political, the cultural, the artistic, the fine arts, the philosophical, the theological, all those disciplines to come together and will have meaningful input into plans of action for those relationships with ET. Well, in any event, I'm sorry.
Oh, no, you're okay.
One addendum.
Go ahead, please.
Yeah, Gary Heseltine. It's called Project Titan. And they have come so far as to cement relationships with the government of San Marino that will offer an unlimited future think tank venue for the ufology institution to come together to share ideas, share thoughts. It's the greatest attempt at having a worldwide ufology organization, such as what you'll see in the professions, the Medical Association, the International Astronomical Union, the Chemical Union, and whatnot. San Marino will be, they've agreed to become the ambassador and the venue for hosting these ufology-related think tanks. So from that step, Gary Heseltine and his group, Project Titan, are working actively to restore and get on the UN's General Assembly deliberations about reopening that UFO office. That is Sir Eric Gary. Yes, he was the one of the main figures back in 1978. And Chris, the UN being the world's only decent example of an organized body, which in its methodology and its potential scope is able to study this phenomenon in the way that I propose that we should be studying it.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, granted, they, much like any body or any major organization, use numerous independent researchers, research organizations, labs, things like that to pass things through. You know, even whenever you're talking UN General Councils on health and stuff like that, they lean a lot on private study, all kinds of things. So you would still be getting, even though it sounds very governmental, folks, you would still be getting that independence, I think, of research in that kind of way. And I think that's where a lot of people's reticence comes in, Keith, you know, especially community wise. It's one of those, it's interesting for me to see how many people in the UFO UAP community did not tune in to the recent UAP hearing. And it's also very interesting for me to hear how many people within the UAP community, UFO community, that did tune in, that utterly dismiss what's going on. Mainly because, like, they aren't, like, bringing forth any evidence. And it's like, oh, no, I think you don't understand. Witness testimony is evidence. Like, it's fully evidence, no different than in a murder trial. Like, witness testimony is evidence. And when people go before Congress and they say, I had this experience, this is what happened to me. Like, one of the guys is still an active duty Navy officer and had permission from the Navy to go and testify about his experience. That's interesting. You know?
And there's so many that have come forward now, the deeper those of us in the ufology community know of many, many examples from 100 years, more than 100 years ago. I've one of my book titles, I did a deep dive into human history going back to Alexander the Great, recorded history about the existence and the experiences that they had with extraterrestrials and UAPs, UFOs, and whatnot. And that's what you mentioned about the recent UAP hearings. Us ufologists are, it's the same thing being played again.
Absolutely.
The lack of disclosure, the secrecy, and everything going involved in it, and those of us that study it have become so attuned to tuning out of it. It's a waste of our time in that you hear the diatribe, and for the most part, the scripts haven't really been changed. The governments will not do for whatever reasons. And to bring up a broader point and tying back into the lack of ability for our world to come together is that different governments throughout the world, and I did a series of YouTube videos on this fairly recently.
They all got different motivations.
The efforts of other governments in terms of ufology and what their cultures, what their populations, what their citizens think, and their activities involved in studying the ET activities. And it's a wide dimension. Some governments actively work with ufologists and the public in terms of promoting information and studying it and whatnot. And on the other end of the dimension, you have those, and I'm sorry, the U.S. is mostly guilty of this.
Yeah.
The government just will not offer any kind of disclosure, but understand too, Chris, some of their reasoning, I'm not condoning it. I'm just making this aware that they have military purposes, priori, and that's going to drive most of everything.
Well, and you know, what you think of him, folks, really is inconsequential. George Knapp brought up some good points during that hearing, and one of those points that I continue to bring up, and that I even bring up with like remote viewing, things like that. It's not that the government and Alphabet agencies don't still use remote viewing; they absolutely do. It's just classified under quote human intelligence. And they aren't personally using it. The contractors that they use to gather that data are using it. So the government has full plausible deniability to say, we don't use that, but their contractors thereof do. And that's just it. And that's what George said. He was like, hey, don't fault Lockheed Martin. Don't fault Bass BAE, you know, or Bigelow Space or anything like that. These are government contractors who have been told to shut up and who have been told to carry on this campaign of secrecy about the materials that they have been given. So they're only doing their due diligence. Like, it's up to you, Congress, to give them the leeway to be able to step outside of that. And he's like, I am in firm belief that many of these companies, even technologically, are looking for an off-ramp. They're looking for the means by which to be able to cooperate with other scientists so that we can actually break this open. Because when you have it compartmentalized for so long, there's only so much actual research that can be done because you aren't sharing data. And that's what science is. So you aren't going to be able to grow it to a larger capacity without it stepping outside of this compartmentalized field. So there's a catch-22 to them having the technology or access to the technology and being able to only back engineer it or future use it so far because there's not more brains working on the problem. You know, like we got to the moon as fast as we did because of the number of brains working on the problem. That's how we got there that fast. That's how science works. So when you're stymieing that, you're stymieing the conversation, and not just for humanity, but for materials science, for energy's sake, and yes, for even national defense sake at that point. And he brought up the very cogent points like you do, like we do on the show all the time. It's the fact of, yes, this is a national defense question. Whether it's China over our skies or aliens, there's some stuff that we can't control or detect with certain platforms. And that's a problem. You know, I'm not saying look at that in a fearful way, but look at it in an informed way. You know, if you're out flying a private jet, you may want to know the traffic that's in your generalized area. Just a thought, you know. It does affect the larger conversation. Now, we've said the whole time, like, you're if you're looking for the aha moment where like they're going to wheel out a gurney with wreckage or a body and a sheet on it and go, here you go, everybody. That's not going to happen. But what's going to happen is a legal tying of the purse strings. Once we get to a point where, like Grush said, my job was to follow the money. And when I followed it to the door, they slammed the door in my face. Well, once we find out who's behind that door, signing the back of the checks and depositing it, then we can hold them accountable, you know, and we'll get an Ollie North eventually who's going to stand up and be like, yes, I work for this Alphabet agency. This is what happened. Checks were cleared. It was black budget money. Something like that will happen as far as big D disclosure. But will we get to see alien wreckage or anything? I doubt that as a society. I doubt that. But that also brings up, once again, this humanized point of expectation that we have, Keith, and even that humanized point of anthropomorphizing, you know, the idea that an alien species would even think like we do in any way, shape or form would look like us, would have to be physical like us, you know, That's a big point that we have to look at, because that's something that we always consider culturally and that we lose track of even with humanity, is the fact of, wait a minute, that's a totally different culture on a totally different side of the world with different social morals and mores. You know, they do not think like you do, even though they look like you do, even though they are human. You know, so the idea that we would anthropomorphize aliens to A, look like us to begin with, or B, even think like us, I think is a big misstep when it comes to the conversation and what kind of conversation you're willing to have.
Yeah. And I mean, the first point with that is our inability as one nation of people to fully understand the cultures of, like you said, like human beings that live in other areas of the world. That's part of the learning curve that I am proposing and promoting that we start to undertake in that this course or this school of our future with ET is going to be mostly about learning about ourselves. And that's where our learning curve is very, very, very high right now.
Yeah.
Again, like you said, we don't understand many cultures from around the world, and they don't necessarily understand us.
Yeah.
Not only in contemporary terms, but going back into more historical or ancient times, in that a big part of my study is involved with our ancestors. Now, as you mentioned, the government will not be rolling out the gurneys or displaying the wreckage.
Not going to happen.
It might be hundreds, if we survive long enough, it might be hundreds of years before a museum pops up with some of those, some artifacts in there or whatnot. So we can't rely currently, we cannot rely on the governments. They have their own rabbit hole agendas of again, the military. And using strategies to obtain funding, such as potentially the purposes behind the Hellfire video episode. There was already budget funding in place by the CIA and other military establishments for additional funding, whether it be black budget or whatever. That was indicated months before the Hellfire videos came out. So, and we know that the governments use private contractors, boy, as one heck of a strategy to foil the FOIA phenomenon.
Absolutely.
So to speak. So we know all of that, and the government will keep doing that stuff. So, knowing that, and knowing that in our community, ET's already here. And again, we're past the acknowledgement, we're past the contact, and we got to get into the purposes and which are the future relationships with them. And we know that the government is not going to help. And this would be a help that, you know, boy, ET, a consortium or a galactic union or whatever representatives would come down and just say, you know, introduce. That's not going to happen. So that's where I pick up the ball and say, okay, recognizing that the biggest factor and learning curve is going to be learning about ourselves in relation to our future with extraterrestrial intelligences. And I'll even throw in the adjunct of the microbial life forms, which is what I think is going to roll out in our society first. The announcement of microscopy life from outside of Earth will happen first, and then the acknowledgement of ET will happen after that.
The microscopy just happened.
Go ahead.
The microscopy just happened. NASA just announced that, like, there is confirmed proof of biologic life on Mars, at least at the microscopic level, at least at the bacterial level. There are at least more than just the microscopic fossils that we found on the meteorite that hit here. Like, they have found them on the surface in their studies, things like that. They just had a press conference like last week.
And when they do this, the requisite studying, the laboratory studying, which is a fantastic aspect of how science operates, but you got to remember there's forensic sciences. But when the laboratory sciences confirm or find that those microbes may be of species and varieties that are already existent on Earth, well, then you've got that option that says, that's just, life as we know it on Earth, blah, 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 that somehow got to Mars, whatever.
Or the other way around, you know, much like was hypothesized whenever the first meteorite was found with the bacteria in it maybe things were ejected from Mars and made it here. And found life within our salty, briny water the same way that it was on Mars.
And I mean, as we've come to find out from our Apollo and the human lunar probes, in that is it Streptococci and other Earth-based bacteria can survive for many, many, many years. So with all the craft that we've sent to Mars, you know, potentially some technician back at NASA or Propulsion Labs or whatever building the spacecraft somehow infected the craft. So when the laboratory sciences confirm that, this is actually life from outside of planet Earth, there's your risk-averse.
That is quite literally, and I saw things. We're gonna now start getting into Three Eye Atlas in this last bit, because I think it's an important part of the current conversation when it comes to alien contact, and B, an important part of the conversation when it comes to science. And let's not forget, before we get any deeper, folks, let's pop that scientific method back up and let's talk about the amazing Avi Loeb, because I love Avi Loeb because of this third step here. See, you start with observation and question, you move to researching a topic area, and then you form a hypothesis. And my friends, that hypothesis can be as hyperbolic as a hypothesis as you want it to be. It can be as outlandish as you want. Now, when it comes to lab science, you test with experiment. Even when it comes to mental experiment science, you test with math, you test with experiment, then you analyze the data, you make experiments, you report conclusions, you wash, rinse, repeat. So Avi Loeb is not wrong, everybody, when he says that there's a small chance, a very small chance. He is hyperbolically hypothesizing the way a good scientist should, okay? Without hyperbolic hypothesis, 90% of what we know as quantum physics would not exist, period. Nobody would have ever explored beyond Newtonian physics, beyond the actual story, which is just a story, mind you, of an apple falling on somebody's head. Okay? So, but without those thought experiments, without the willingness of thought experiment, and the observation of something and going, ooh, what about this? We wouldn't be where we are as science. So good for you, Avi Loeb, for throwing it out there, man. Just throwing it out there as hard as you can over the plate. Let's see if something lands on home, you know. But we also have to look at the statistics. We have to remember Oumuamua sent no signal. It wasn't anything like that. It was just a floating piece of rock that went past, no incident. The sphericals that may be alien technology, I will give you, the tests are still fully out. So there's a 50% there. Right now he's shooting like a 0.5 percentile. He's shooting like a half percentile. So am I going to jump into the basket of the hyperbolic hypothesis that this is anything less than a comet? No. I won't. I will open my mind to the conversation of a thought experiment, things like that. Absolutely. All day long, because that's science and that's literal physics and the way that physicists work. However, man, when you start looking at the images that are posted online and on social media about 3i Atlas, it's one of those like, this is a fully AI generated image. This is not a real image. This is like, we do not have telescopes that can see that far. We do not have telescopes that can see that far in that kind of detail, especially with a fully moving object like that. You know,
and we're getting better at it.
We're getting better at it, no doubt. But you know, I have the most recent images, and here I'll bring up some of the most recent images of Comet 3i Atlas, folks, just so you can see actual telescope images of what it looks like. This is the best we got, okay? At least, it looks
available
like
to us
in every day. Well, and you know, available even from James Webb Telescope, things like that. Like those are incredibly. Whenever you see things like the pillars of creation, stuff like that, even its images
declassified.
I'm not in the realm of alien craft, you know. Because, most of the images that are out there from actual sources about astronomy and everything else are not saying that. The results aren't saying that. So is it a strange thing? Yes, absolutely. Its name belies the strangeness. We've only just started looking for interstellar objects coming into our range. The Atlas telescope array did not start until like 2015, something like that. And the first object it found was Oumuamua, you know. But there's only been three. That's the designation, 3i, third interstellar, Atlas being the telescope. So that's where its name is derived from. So in that amount of time, 10 years, we have found exactly three interstellar objects that have come into our solar system. But that's also, I think, very much like the phenomena that we saw with drones, Keith, where once Congress said there's a bunch of drones, what about these things appearing? Because that was the second UAP hearing where they were like, why aren't we having a larger conversation about this? And Lou Elizondo and many people spoke up and said, because it would expose a gaping hole in our security at secure facilities where we cannot detect these platforms. And then the next thing that happened within weeks was drones appearing over sensitive areas, and we can't tell what they are. And the next thing we had was a drone hearing about releasing funding for finding out about
there
drones.
You know,
it was a very predictable dialogue that was followed through. But it was also the fact of funny thing, how when people started looking up for more drones, they started seeing more drones. Like, the more we start adding to the Atlas telescope array and the more we start looking for interstellar objects moving toward our location, the more we're going to find them. That's, you know, that's kind of Occam's razor for me. So I have not gone down the rabbit hole of panic, as a lot of people in the community have, to the point of rapture occurring tomorrow, the 23rd of September, you know, things like that. Or 24th of September. I'm sorry. 24th. I haven't gone to that point yet. And it's funky to see how many people in the community have when we have not had that scientific proof yet? And I'm a believer's believer. I firmly believe, once again, they are here, not like coming. They're here, you know. And I know that there are fully unclassified images, things like that. Like, we talk all the time about how even the Hubble Space Telescope, funny how when it launched, it was nearsighted because it was actively based on an NRO office, a National Reconnaissance Office satellite that was made to look at Earth. That's why.
Yep.
It was built on that. That's why they randomly had a mirror that would fit it. So
yeah, the design flaws, so to speak.
Exactly.
So no, we should think the Avi Loeb is just another example of the broader scope of keeping the narrative open.
Yeah.
In terms of utilizing new technologies, new creations, new inventions, and the mushrooming effect that those things have. I mean, like you mentioned, the Atlas platforms only became into existence about 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Now, whether I'm going to bring up the next example,
Go ahead.
Seems that only a few months later, NASA broadcast the existence of this RAMA technology, which is a reconstituting asteroids for mechanical automata is the precise title of it. But translated, what that means is that NASA scientists started looking at asteroids, natural phenomenon that have velocities still faster, much faster than what our human-powered satellites and spacecraft can do, but converting those asteroids into propulsion mechanisms and then equipping the asteroids with instrumentation for whatever purpose you wanted to do, and to use that as effectively spacecraft.
Absolutely.
I mean, this is, an elaboration or an evolution of a new technology that spawned the new hypothesis creation, generations and whatnot, and the mushrooming effects.
Yeah, if we're considering it, why wouldn't they? That was the idea, was that if we're considering using this kind of technology, why wouldn't a more advanced civilization? Why wouldn't they just find something that is on trajectory of where you're trying to go and use its natural inertia? Drop your target packages of material. Hey, you could even like hitch a ride on it, construct things, and then leave, you know, things like that. So yeah, if we would consider doing that with a moving asteroid, why wouldn't a more advanced civilization? That's a beautiful protracted concept in that kind of way.
And a fiscally inexpensive one relative to many other potential questions of human spaceships and space travel and whatnot. Yep, there's were four scientists in the original RAMA team who. Yeah. So it's a good thing that you know, Dr. Loeb is open-minded enough, that's a very big problem with the science communities in many ways, in that there's they have an intelligence bias, or they have a how will I put this? They can often play games of mental Olympics with the public that they're trying to inform and educate and teach and whatnot. But part of the science and part of that science methodology, there should be inserted in there an open-mindedness to look at new observations of nature. And that may lead to the development of newer or additional questions, and then throwing back into the methodology loop of study collecting data analysis and whatnot. And that's the laboratory. And, yep. and you also have to remember that the forensic sciences will be and have been always as important as the laboratory sciences. And in my That's studies right. Extensively now for years of our ancestors, the human mind thought the same way 10,000 years ago.
Just as fearfully.
It does today.
Just as fearfully. You know,
with all the attributes,
to the point of like, no, we need to sacrifice people on the regs so that the sun rises. You know, things like that. So that's what's funny is tens of thousands of years later, Keith, we are no more evolved than that mentality of like where there, you know, there's still that sensationalistic mentality. And there's, and once again, the idea that Avi Loeb is willing to put himself out there as a scientist and remind people that a scientist is supposed to be like Magellan and say, just give me a group of ships. We're going to sail to the horizon. I know you think it's flat, but let's find out, you know? And you got to be willing to do that at some point as a scientist and put yourself out there with that kind of hypothesis. So good for him for doing so. I say bad on the media for latching on to a very sensational bite and carrying it to the end. Granted, putting it out there as scientist says aliens on the way, things like that are many of the headlines coming from major news to begin with. Which is how you get the conflagration within communities that then leads to fear and an overall, sadly, fear-based myth. Like that's a lot of what we talk about with Daniel Hariri and the Hollywood Disclosure Alliance and things like that. The idea of like, how do we change that narrative with the media? How do we change that narrative with movies? And that aspect of approaching this concept of first contact with a military sense of fear, you know, because that's a, if we're expecting them to be more enlightened, then we need to be more enlightened, you know, if we're going to anthropomorphize them into being a more enlightened species than humanity, then we need to collectively lift ourselves up to the level that, hey, if we were at that level, would we have the same understanding, the same empathetic understanding, you know, because it may be the fact that they're so evolved that the cold calculating decision of Thanos is much more likely, where they're like, well, you know, sadly, it's much more calculative that if we keep expanding and we allow y'all to keep breeding, that this planet will cease to exist. So we're just going to wipe half of you out to balance the scales cosmically. See ya. That's the fear that we could live in. So those are the questions that we have to be willing to ask ourselves without jumping into the skin of fear, without letting fear rule the conversation. And I think without letting the hyperbole of that hypothesis rule the conversation, you know, because there's a much bigger scientific conversation going on as well.
Yeah, media long ago discovered a way of entertainment is to scare us for their financial and fiscal gain.
That's right.
And unfortunately, the government's operations and perpetuation of their secrecy activities just kind of plays hand in hand.
Yeah.
The broadcast of how we see ET. I mean, it's potentially, yes, there may be a fear factor involved in planning for those potentials that may have a military or a warlike endpoint to them. Yep. But there are many other potentials, too, for those purposes, those relationships with ET, not just, conquering or taking over or, from the old science fiction TV show, The Invaders, or, things like that. There's other potential purposes to be studied, but unfortunately, the predominant one that's been pushed on society is the one that's perpetuated by the media and supported in their attitudes and behaviors by the governments.
Yeah, yeah, precisely. And you know, one of the things that I bring up regularly on the show that we talked about a lot over the 9/11 convention is Operation Mockingbird, which you can find the documents for that on our Knowledge Vault, folks. Just go to curiousrealm.com/knowledge and go to the declassified section. You will find, here it is right here, the CIA Operation Mockingbird, quote, Family Jewels document, which basically, and it's 700 pages, so get ready for a thick one. But the whole concept between Operation Mockingbird was to literally implant operatives in the media to push approved stories, propaganda stories, things like that.
Yep.
Now, this was supposedly denied, things like that. But it's very funny how when you start looking at the actions in 2012 of striking down the Smith-Mundt Act. The Smith-Mundt Act is what prevented the federal government from telling the news what to say. And that was stricken down in 2012. So when you start looking at that, and then shortly afterward, it was revealed that like the government tried putting official narrators into newsrooms to like, you know, disseminate the official news from the government to the news, stuff like that. And it was a fascinating chain of events to follow in 2012 as all of that was really peeled back. So when you start looking at things like Operation Mockingbird and the literal plan to do so, the idea that, you know, it's been much like it was released through Leslie Keen about the black money, black funds and UFOs that led to a lot of this conversation in the halls of Congress, things like that. There was a much more recent article that talked about, yes, how they used the UFO community against itself and as a means by which to come up with cover for black budget programs. So they were quite literally using the concept of Operation Mockingbird, where they just basically sit back, listen to the communities and go, okay, this is what people are saying as far as UFOs and stuff like that. Let's lean into that and use that as a cover for Program B. Like literally using us against ourselves and using our mentality against ourselves. And that was kind of the whole point of Mockingbird, was the idea of destabilizing a society through what you put. Because a destabilized society isn't watching what the left hand is doing. A destabilized society is controllable from the top down because people are just looking for stability. You know, so yep, it's fascinating.
It's our human
fascinating. And that's just it. You know, we have to be willing to see that larger conversation as humanity and how we even affect each other in that kind of way, Keith. Because, yeah, we're controlling a lot of the way that this conversation is going. So I'm of the opinion the more people we can get on board with it, the better off we are. Will we? Once again, I don't think even the conversation of ET contact is going to lead us to the aha moment of things being revealed on the floor of Congress, but it will lead to where the purse strings are tied to, and you can strangle people with purse strings, you know? And that I think is what's going to get us to a point of larger conversation with society, to a point of getting a lot of the people who are even reticent to have the conversation of alien life even existing ready to have some kind of conversation, because that's where we need to be. We're still at a point where a lot of humanity is still very afraid about a lot of this.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, my thanks to government people, Nancy Mace and Anna Luna and Ron Rubio.
More power to them.
And that community for
get after him. Get after him.
Yeah, that's pushback. Pushback.
That's
keep
it.
Pushing back. And this is the pushback to promote and I don't want to say, elevate the ufology, which is known as a pseudoscience, pushing it past the threshold into mainstream science, something that has existed, is real, will continue to be real, will continue to exist. So, and we know what we're up against in the government's tactical display and whatnot, and strategizing. So the pushback is necessary, and never quit doing that. You know, to continue doing that to where we can get new levels of cooperation. You know, not only in the U.S., but this is pretty much a human being species phenomenon in many situations. The attitudes and the behaviors just play out that way.
Yeah, yeah. And we as, once again, you bring it full circle, we as humanity need to be ready to have that conversation beyond the bounds of our thin blue veil that exists around this planet, you know? Which means we need to be able to have a global conversation to begin with. We need to be able to talk with each other as humanity to begin with. So any return to that, anybody who is working on that. And I will say I enjoyed hearing that. And I want to say it was maybe Congressman Bruchette on the committee who was like, you know, talking about Marco Rubio and like, I disagree with that guy about 95% of things. But I am glad to see that we can agree on this and that this is important, you know, and to see the bipartisanship that is going on in that committee to have oversight and to bring in the reins of, once again, those government contractors who, as Eisenhower told us years ago, that's literally what he was warning about, was the idea that we had to give a lot of things over to government contractors to win that war. In the speed and expediency in which we did. And when we did that, we had to give up partially part of our rights constitutionally. And there were extra constitutional things that were happening. And if we allowed them to keep happening, that we would be on a very, very bad road. And that's very much where we're at now, you know, where, yeah, now trying to hold those people responsible for extra constitutional actions may be hard. You know,
because getting harder.
Yeah, yeah.
And getting harder.
Because they've been doing it in the interest of, quote, national security. You know, so it's going to be interesting to see how things play out. But it's going to be great to begin to at least hydro crack the rocks that have been hiding these things for years. It's going to take a lot of heating and cooling of these things to crack the facade that's there, Keith. But I think much like any ancient civilization that built great monuments, we will eventually begin to crack the quarry and be able to pull out big chunks of rocks and build new things with them. So
absolutely. Yep. Yep. So it's a long game. It's not going to happen. Probably won't happen as a eureka moment, but as most things don't do,
that's
but,
right.
You know, it's a process.
Exactly. So. Exactly. And it's a process that, you know, we all get to take part in. We all get to take part in preparing humanity for that by preparing ourselves. So I want to thank you as always for the time. Thank you so much for literally randomly hopping on a show to fill in for our good friend, Mike, who ended up with horrible food poisoning. So hope you're feeling better out there, buddy. I know that pain all too well.
I hope so.
Thanks again, as always, for coming on the show, for having this incredible large, deep conversation, Keith, because it's a thick one to get through that I hope humanity is ready for. And heart-wise, I hope we can all get to a point of being able to hear each other beyond the rabble so that we can get there. Let everybody know where they can go to find your books, where they can go to keep up with everything that is the Humaniverse, because you've got new content coming out. You've got a new book coming out. So where can they go to follow everything that is Keith Seelan in the Humaniverse, buddy?
Yeah, the books are all of the print books, all available at Barnes & Noble and Amazon and Apple. And I'm getting ready, like I said, new title. It's in the editing process. That will be probably released next year. Also in the works is audiobook versions of the titles that I have out. So that's another project that's in the works, and it's past the first step for that. So that should be, hopefully, the first one may come out by the holidays this year. Then the Humaniverse website, the Humaniverse.org, basically my platform is you can search engine it through the Humaniverse. Google it, and everything about myself, the website, the books, and whatnot will come up. I'm doing some more lecturing in Upper Peninsula, Michigan in a couple weeks, and then I'll be in Roswell. The awesome. Weekend before Halloween at the museum there. So it's an open, just come in, and I'll be giving talks and lectures and Q&As and open-ended discussions, whatnot. I'll be in the next week after that in Baltimore at the Mysteries of Space and Sky conference. And then at the end of the year, research boots back on, and I'll be trekking down to spend New Year's week in Easter Island.
Oh, wow. The Rapa Nui. Too cool, man.
Down in Philly. That's going to be, Times Square is nothing on Easter Island as far as New Year's goes. That's
absolutely
going to be just an awesome, awesome trip. So, yep. So that's the exclamation point for this year's activity. So look at anything, the Humaniverse, and all of my works will pop up, and I always like to thank all my audiences, Chris, wherever I speak to communities and the public in that without you, these events and these conversations do not happen.
Yep.
So if I can help educate the public in moving the needle towards not only acknowledgement and contact, but planning for those future relationships with ET, I'm more than happy and gracious to actually and grateful for your listening audience within to do that.
Absolutely, Keith, and I'm the same way. You know, it's one of those as a former youth minister and substitute teacher and teacher of spirituality, things like that. It's one of those, if I can see an light bulb go on, that's all I need. I have reached somebody in the universe, which is the whole purpose of all of this. And if that one person is prepared and spreads that light, that's what it's about. So I want to thank you as always for the conversation, because it's always great chatting with you, always great catching up. And we'll get into our throw out line, which is very much echoed from what you were just saying, Keith. While you are online checking out everything from the Humaniverse and Keith Steele and everybody at thehumaniverse.org, make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. Curious Realm is where you can like, follow, subscribe. That is where you can find our knowledge vault full of declassified scientific studies, court documents, all the unredacted Epstein files that are available are there, folks. Stop on by, check that out at curiousrealm.com. And that's also where you can find your link to Curious Research, which is our endeavor to prepare the world of paranormal and science to shake hands. That's where you can get your copy of the observation and field log. If you are an investigator in the world of UFOs, UAPs, ancient civilizations, cryptozoology, what have you, even a geologist, this is your field log to be able to write down scientific things that as they happen to you in the field, make a sketch, all kinds of things. Stop on by, get your copy of that. All proceeds go to help further the bridging of scientific and paranormal, everyone. And as always, thank you so much for your time. Thank you so much for your open hearts, your open minds. That is what makes the conversation. Without the conversation, humanity does not march forward. So remember, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and we'll see you in episode 200 next week, everybody. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of The Curious Realm. Stay tuned for more guests, forbidden topics, and hidden truths. Follow us on social media by searching Curious Realm.
To download the official Curious Realm app and view the Knowledge Vault, or become a sponsor of Curious Realm, visit our website at CuriousRealm.com. Curious Realm is available on your favorite podcast and video services, CuriousRealm.com, as well as KGRA Radio, APR TV, and the official Curious Realm app for Roku devices. Curious Realm is a proud member of the Ground Zero Media family of podcasts. For more shows and members-only content, visit groundzeroplus.com today. Thanks for listening. Stay curious. And remember, the other side is always watching.